you think of these new inclusion standards for films?
They make me vomit because this is an art form and no one should be telling me as an artist that I have to give in to the latest, most current idea of what morality is.
That's actor Richard Dreyfuss responding to Hollywood's new push for diversity and new standards for eligibility for the Best Picture Oscar.
Are we crazy? Do we not know that art is art? This is so patronizing.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast. In real life and in the movies, Richard Dreyfuss is an oversized presence who has been entertaining audiences for more than half a century.
Well, this is not a boat accident. It wasn't any propeller. It wasn't any coral reef. And it wasn't Jack the Ripper. It was a shark.
He's known for his iconic roles in films like Jaws, The Goodbye Girl, and Mr. Holland's Opus.
I'll bet all of you, whether you know it or not, already like Johann Sebastian Bach.
Dreyfuss has taken on a new role off-screen as an advocate for civics education.
The smarter the voter, the better the government.
With his Dreyfuss Civics Initiative, the Academy Award-winning actor is working to reverse a decades-long decline in civics in schools that he believes threatens the future of our nation.
I think we're in the end game right now. I think that we could let slip the greatest idea for governance ever devised, and we won't even know that it happened.
Dreyfuss also says we need to relearn how to respect political opponents.
I still can't really wrap my head around the fact that people confuse being exposed to an opposing view on any subject with being a traitor or with being a subversive.
But does he practice what he preaches?
This has nothing to do with the politics of things. But I am against the man, Donald Trump, because he has no simple common decency.
Richard Dreyfuss.
Hi.
Welcome to Firing Line.
It's been years. I wanted this for so long.
You have portrayed notable American figures from Vice President Dick Cheney to Secretary of State Alexander Haig, to Ponzi scheme scam artist Bernie Madoff. And you have often said that you would like to play Ulysses S. Grant. As a student of American history, are there other uncommon Americans you would like to portray?
Aaron Burr.
Why?
Because I don't think he ever did anything wrong. And I think he...
Go on.
No, not only that. But I did a show once for the History Channel, and we called it The Duel. And ultimately, it was about the duel. Mm-hmm. But it was also my attempt to at least expose people to the idea that this guy had not done anything wrong. And he actually had one strong step in the 18th century and one strong step in the 21st. And he was a very remarkable man in either century. And he said things that were adorable. Like he once said to a bunch of lawyers, never write anything down because someday someone may read it. And I think that's great.
You say Aaron Burr, but at the time that Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton, he was widely reviled.
No.
He was essentially exiled and moved west in the United States. Why Aaron Burr? Do you feel drawn towards characters in history who are misunderstood or who deserve a more nuanced understanding?
I was going to teach a class once in misguided heroes, people who were interpreted as villains and who did not deserve it. And at that time, Aaron Burr was the top of that list. But there were others. And Warren Harding is one. And Herbert Hoover was another. And seriously, there are lots of heroes who aren't or shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And we've We've done our level best to either confuse ourselves with history or just hope that no one notices how badly we teach it.
Well, you have been warning Americans for more than two decades about our failure to teach the next generation civics.
Right.
You spent 4 years researching civics at Oxford, and out of it came a book, One Thought Scares Me. We teach our children what we wish them to know. We do not teach our children what we don't wish them to know.
Right.
How do you define civics?
Civics are the tools that allow you to understand the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Why, for instance, are there some bills, some rights that are included within the Constitution and some that are not?
It's the rules of the road in democracy?
Well, it's how do you get there? And it included the ideas that you needed critical analysis. You needed to have a clear head, and reason and logic were a part and parcel of civics. And if you didn't learn reason and common sense, you were left behind. And it demanded that the people know how to explore an issue and not just vote. And that is all civics. So there's civics in English grammar, there's civics in English literature, and there's civics in science and art, and there's a civil society. You can't have a civil society without an attempt at civics, without an attempt at not just common sense, but a willingness to risk. America was, at one time, the epitome of risk in so many ways. And now we run from that whole concept like screaming children.
You attribute the decline in civics education to the 1970s, when young adults who had experienced the social upheaval from that period began to serve in public office and on school boards. You were born in 1947, which makes you among the last generation to receive a solid civics education in the public schools in this country. What do you recall about your own civics education?
I had two teachers in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. And they were both ardent Republican, and my mother was a communist, and she wasn't kidding. And we were raised in a very leftist community, and I remember that Mrs. Palmer never tried to keep her GOP atmosphere away from her teaching. She taught as a Republican, and that was good. That was fine. And my mom and she, Mrs. Palmer, had a debate for 3 years, and I carried the water so that she would say something about whatever, and my mother would respond, and then she would say something else. And for instance, she talked at one point about how the South was always giving these signals about how to stop the war and how to. And my mother says, if you can point out one example of the South really wanting to stop the war and give up slavery, I'll buy you a hat. And
so they would debate American history.
Absolutely.
But did you feel that you got a partisan view of American history in your civics education?
I got the perfect.
You're saying the Republican perspective is the perfect perspective, Richard Dreyfuss?
No, I'm saying that the debate between my mother and Mrs. Palmer was
the perfect balance.
Yeah.
What do you recall about your own civics education that's lacking today?
The honor of dissent. Mm. The idea that you sought the truth in history, and you didn't fool around about it. You told the truth, period. And that was that. And anyone who had a brain in their head knew that you don't stop at the water's edge and not commit to critical analysis. And if you're going to talk about the Indians, you're going to talk about the Indians and what we did to them and why and what they did to each other. Here's something I've not ever said out loud. If I get a chance to create a curriculum for kids in grammar school, the first 2 years is not going to include any Europeans at all. I want to spend at least a year on the physical creation of North America, on the whether it's the Siberian land bridge or Polynesia or wherever they came from, and then to talk about their society before we showed up. And we still do it. I just did it just then when I said we. I still think of it like we're the Europeans. I'm an American, and I really am an American, and I really love being an American. That's not being a European. Yeah. And yet our story doesn't begin until the Europeans have arrived.
Well, you have created a kind of curriculum, haven't you? You launched in 2006 the Dreyfus Civics Initiative to promote civics education, starting in fourth grade and lasting through high school, covering topics ranging from the formation of North America, as you just said, to civil governance. Have you had success in bringing attention to civics education? How do you measure the success of your civics initiative?
No, first of all, it's gradual. And this interview is part of it. I'm building a constituency for the return and revival of civics in public schools. That's what I want. I want the people to remember or to be reminded or whatever, that they are the sovereign power here. And that means that literally we, the people, that phrase is a very clear indicator of who has sovereign power, who's the most powerful, and how. And the fact is, it's a flaw in the Constitution that we don't create a picture of how that thing can occur. In other words, we say something about sovereign power. We say that the people are the sovereign power in this country. But because we don't describe it in any manner, way, or shape, or form, the people are left outside of the process. And all they need is, when you read the Constitution, you're going to read a very sparse illustration of executive power in the executive branch. It's oddly very Spartan and lean, and it doesn't say a lot. And the reason and the way the executive branch gained power was individual presidents in that job and faced with the fact that every other branch of government was closed and on vacation. When Jefferson was president and the Tripoli pirates were demanding tribute from America, it was not the executive who had the power to deal with that. And yet, his political philosophy was against it also, but he was the only office that was open. So he executed an order for a navy, and he sent that navy to Tripoli, and they behaved like an American navy. And The guy who built it was the guy who was totally and completely opposed to doing that. And so did, and Lincoln did the same thing. There was no one else there when the Southern states seceded. And he assumed the power he had to assume. So he spent most of the war years being accused of impeachable offenses by one group or impeachable offenses by another. In fact, he did what he had to do.
A national report card was issued this week showing that history and civics scores dropped for eighth graders. Fewer than one in four students is, quote, proficient in civics. The Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania says that a majority of Americans cannot name all three branches of government, and nearly one in 10 can't identify a single branch of government. You know, you have called the failure to teach the United States Constitution, quote, suicidal. And you say that everyone, from our lawmakers to our parents to the media, is responsible and, quote, guilty of collusion in the crime of killing America. Is that hyperbole, or do you really think we're near the end?
I think we're in the end game right now. I think that we could let slip the greatest idea for governance ever devised, and we won't even know that it happened. We have no muscle memory of it. 50 years is a long time when it comes to how many generations have been without civic education. And civic education is not just history, but it's a lot. And there's so many things that are just skipped over and we think are not important anymore.
You write in your book, quote, "It is especially absurd to think our children could run this complex country without learning anything about its government first. We can't fly a plane without training or practice medicine without attending medical school. Then explain how we can send people to Congress who haven't first learned the workings of government or what powers the Congress has." What will it take to elevate this issue? And why aren't more people talking about this?
So there was a generation of people who thought that they were doing the right thing by cutting participatory citizenship out of the goals of education. They thought that they were doing the right thing. Left to themselves, they probably would have realized that they were making a mistake and would have revised what they were actually up to. But before that could happen, the profiteers got hold of it. There are people in this country who want to make money from everything. I live in San Diego. In San Diego, there are more doctors than you can shake a stick at. And they all have these little cards that say concierge medicine. All of them. And it means pay more, get better service. Somewhere in the book, I say that I have spoken in front of enormous crowds of people who, and I can see the outrage grow on their face. And that outrage disappears before they get to their cars. And somehow I lose them. Somehow it gets lost. The urgency, do you know enough to realize how rare and how few people have ever had a fair shake on this planet? And that's why I spend so much time describing what it was like before 1776 and what we did. We were the first. Yeah. So that by giving, by allowing people to be educated, we were giving them a chance to create an intellectual resource pool that was second to none and was, in fact, the power behind the government. And that's something we've given up without a thought. We don't even think that it's valuable. And yet, it's everything.
New citizens to this country study civics, and they have to pass a citizenship test, every single one, in order to become an American. Why shouldn't every high school graduate have to pass the exact same citizenship test that immigrants to our country pass?
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? I have no argument with it at all. I have an argument with people who spend a lot of their time arguing with the fundamental of opposing views. I still can't really wrap my head around the fact that people confuse being exposed to an opposing view on any subject with being a traitor or with being a subversive. And that's a kind of nonsense that is so immature that it's beyond the immaturity of normal adults. It's a terrible obligation of stupidity. It's like we have to prove how dumb we are. And not having opposing views, we have 333 million people in this country. We're all going to have one view? Are you crazy? And that's what we are. We have become neurotic. We are a neurotic public.
You're familiar with the controversy over school boards removing books that they consider woke from curricula and school libraries. It's a new version of an old argument about where we draw the line between a parent's right and the government's responsibility. A parent's right to have a view about what their child is taught and the government's responsibility to educate the public. This was an issue when William F. Buckley Jr. had a debate about school textbooks on his program.
We feel it's very much of an indoctrination. For instance, in the government books, you'll over and over have little sentences about the need for government control, government regulation, government power, and so forth. Never any emphasis upon individualism. The emphasis is always upon the government being a solution for every problem. The schools are teaching values diametrically opposed to the values upon which our nation was founded.
Whether it would follow that we would have a virtuous society if virtues were in fact taught is by no means established historically. However, the question does arise whether you, as a Texan, and Mrs. Gabler, have a right to object to what you allege is a monopoly in the opinions that are forwarded in the textbooks that are taught to your children, your grandchildren.
Well, we feel there's a virtual monopoly of all your values in all the textbooks, regardless of the subject or grade.
You know, there has been this push and pull over time that we've seen in the last 40 years in American history about what materials should be taught. How do you think about this?
I think we're cowards. I think we have taken the word risk out of the equation. We send our children to schools, Republicans send their children to schools hoping and praying that their children will come back Republicans. And Democrats send their children to school urgently praying that their children will come back Democrats. And they are confusing what to think with how to think. And it sounds like a good thing, but the idea that a parent would walk into a public school and say, I don't want my children exposed to opposing views, and a principal is going to be so stupid as to shut down debate, that's wrong. That's wrong of the parent. The parent is not serving the child's best interest. And especially because we introduced a revolutionary idea to education, that there would be no one left out of education, that you could educate all And that all meant all. And that's a huge difference with every empire and every nation that preceded us.
You were once a Democrat, and now you consider yourself pre-partisan.
Right.
I've heard you criticize the lack of civility in both parties. You write, quote, "Currently, without examples of civility, Americans tend to treat opposing views as the positions of enemies, instead of regarding the exchange of opposing views as normal. Americans hate one another." Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has called Democrats a party of pedophiles. Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says there is a, quote, "crime wave within the GOP." Is the tone and tenor of our rhetoric, particularly our political rhetoric that has degraded, a result of a decline in civics education?
Yes, it is. It's also the addition of television and technology.
So do people who are on television, like you, have a special responsibility to contribute to the rhetoric that we have and we are experiencing in our country?
Yes, they do.
I want to show you a clip from 2016 of an interview you gave after playing Bernie Madoff.
What was it like playing arguably the most despicable man in modern history?
Actually, he is the second most despicable man because I've already played Dick Cheney. So I have to say that he was the second, and I loved playing them both.
So when you see that, how do you think about your contribution to the rhetoric? Is calling him the most evil person in American history contributing negatively to the rhetoric?
Well, if you don't believe in having a sense of humor, yes, I suppose. Although I do assume that people do have a sense of humor and they can laugh along with me when I say something like
that. So you don't really mean that he's the most evil person in American history?
No kidding. No kidding.
You've called Donald Trump disgusting, dangerous pig, and said that his celebrity supporters are whores.
I have said that?
Yeah. Those were tweets from 2016. Are they consistent with your views of civility now? Or would characterizing celebrity supporters of Republicans...
Am I breaking my own rule of civility by calling them
whores? Yeah, or is that... Yeah, if...
Yeah, I suppose that... I could be nailed for that. I also think that if there was a culture that supported civility and we had reference to it and we knew what it was,
yeah,
that I would have never have broken that, you know, crossed that line. I did say to one guy on Fox, the business guy.
Neil Cavuto?
Yeah, yeah. He said to me, "What do you think of the president's military budget?" And I said, "The president's military budget? You mean the president? I'm sorry. I just don't think of it as the president's military budget because he's an idiot." And he said, "You shouldn't say that about the president." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because he's the president of the United States and you shouldn't, it's disrespectful to call him an idiot." And I looked at him and I said, "Okay, while we're on this show, I apologize, I take it back. I don't want to offend you. So I will not call him an idiot while I'm on this show. But to say that he's not an idiot is a stretch of your reality. And I'm sorry, he behaves in front of the CIA. He behaves as in front of the parents of a dead SEAL. He's an idiot. And he's a moral problem. This has nothing to do with the politics of things. But I am against the man, Donald Trump, because he has no simple common decency. And I think that the fact that he's taken seriously enough to represent us as president is an illustration of a decay in our society that is terrible.
Shifting gears entirely. Starting in 2024, films will be required to meet new inclusion standards to be eligible for the Academy Awards for Best Picture. They'll have to have a certain percentage of actors or crew from underrepresented racial and ethnic groups, or have people with cognitive or physical disabilities on staff. What do you think of these new inclusion standards for films?
They make me vomit.
Why?
Because this is an art form. It's also a form of commerce, and it makes money, but it's an art. And no one should be telling me, as an artist, that I have to give in to the latest, most current idea of what morality is. And I'm sorry, we don't trust ourselves enough. I mean, what we're saying is, if we leave it up to you actors and directors, you're just going to tell stories and you're not going to have any social obligations. And that's terrible. No, it isn't. That's just who's running things and what are we risking? Are we really risking hurting people's feelings? You can't legislate that. And you have to let life be life.
Do you think it will change the quality of the productions negatively?
Well, it certainly takes away valuable time from creating a great movie by making sure that you have a representative crew. It certainly is a little silly. And I'm sorry, I don't think that there's a minority or a majority in the country that has to be catered to like that. Yeah. I don't think that it has any guts or moral courage to make a film or make a play that ignores it. You know, there's a true incident that happened in the 20th century, and that was that Laurence Olivier was the last white actor to play Othello. And he did it in 1965. And he did it in blackface. And he lowered his voice 2 octaves. And he played a black man brilliantly. Am I being told that I will never have a chance to play a black man? Is someone else being told that if they're not Jewish, they shouldn't play The Merchant of Venice?
Mm-hmm.
Are we crazy? Do we not know that art is art? This is so patronizing. It's so thoughtless and treating people like children.
Do you think there's a difference between the question of representation and who is allowed to represent other groups? For example, as you said, somebody representing The Merchant of Venice. And the case of blackface explicitly in this country, given the history of slavery and the sensitivities around black racism, do you think there's a difference between those?
There shouldn't be.
Why?
Because it's patronizing. Because it says that we're so fragile that we can't have our feelings hurt. We have to anticipate having our feelings hurt, our children's feelings. We don't know how to stand up and bop the bully in the face. And that's as important as anything else. I tend to think I participated once in a reading of a play that was very well known in the 60s called Steam Bath. And after the reading was over, the artistic director asked, was anyone offended by anything in this play? And two girls put their hands up and said, yes, I was offended by the use of the term dyke, and I was offended by the use of the term queer. And he said something like, well, we're thinking of making certain changes, but I'm not sure yet. And I raised my hand and I said, if you make any changes like that, we will no longer know what progress we've made as a culture. That play was written in 1964. And that's how we talked about them in 1964. We'll never know that. Mm-hmm. We will confuse the issue. And don't do that.
Do you think, as we tell stories about our past, it is a sign of progress that we tell an expanded version of our past, that we explore maybe hidden figures from history who had been forgotten because they had been written out of a narrative? You know, Black female physicists who contribute to NASA's advancement into space, for example, or women's contributions that had previously been written out of history. Do you agree that there is a fuller version of our history that is perhaps more inclusive to the diversity of the country now? Or,
you know, I once worked for a guy who was making a film about the gangsters of the 30s. I said, why did you change this incident and that incident? Why did you change that from the reality? Because the reality was so much more interesting than what you created. And he said that he wanted to make people, you know, like, be excited about this time of history. I said, well, you had it. You had it in reality. It was done. And you, by changing it, you made it simple and smaller. And I totally believe that you can make a great film or a great painting or a great opera out of the truth first. And try that first. And then if you can't do it, then make up some nonsense. But don't tell me you can't do that, that history isn't that interesting.
Final question. In 2020, you said, quote, I don't go to a lot of movies anymore because I don't like them. They're not very good anymore. And I probably have missed out on a bunch of really good films, but they're mostly crap. Why do you think modern films are mostly crap?
Because we're going through this strange need to not create, but to create sequels. Sequels are death. Sequels are like, you find out that you're in a Charles Dickens novel and you can't get out, and you're in a sequel. And the original film is about superpowers, and we'll do a sequel. Or there was a sequel to Jaws, but there wasn't. No sequel. No, not never, never came close to the brilliance of the first Jaws. And I'm very proud of that.
Yeah,
and
well,
very happy about
it. I thank you for my phobia of sharks for my entire life.
Me too. I admit it. I won't go in. I'm the same way. But I tell you, it's one thing to be around a generation of people who went for it, who risked it, who said, let's go for it. And they did. And they made great films. And I would much rather them be in the seat of the decisions of what films are made by a studio or not, than to have them made by corporate or ministers of some kind. You know, I always wanted to be a rabbi. Nah, I'll go into showbiz and be a rabbi there. Silly.
Richard Dreyfuss, Thank you for coming to Firing Line, and thank you for sharing your views.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.